Good afternoon. I call Human Services Finance Committee to order. Members, we have a quorum present. And with that, I would like to begin with the approval of minutes for April 11, 2024. Vice Chair Barney, did you want to move the approval for minutes?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to move the minutes for April 11th, 2024.
Vice Chair Banner moved the approval of minutes for April 11th, 2024. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. The minutes for April 11th, 2024 are now approved. Members, we have our bill before us, so I the House file, I'll move House File 5280 to be before the committee, and we will start with. We're not adopting anything, it's just that we are going to have the walkthrough for the bill. And we will start with the fiscal analyst. Doug Begg will walk us through the spreadsheet.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Doug Berg. I'm House Fiscal Staff. Members should have in their packet a legal size spreadsheet. And just to orient you to the spreadsheet, it is the Human Services 2024 Supplemental Finance Bill. This is, as you'll see, labeled in the right-hand columns. Are the House DE amendment, and that's what these numbers represent. In the middle columns are the governor's recommendations, and on the left are the items and the verbiage. Starting on line 13, if you go to the 24-25 columns under the House, you'll see that the net general fund expenditure for this bill is $42,130,000 in 24-25. And going over to the right-handmost column, the tails on this, the general fund tails, are $14,860,000. You'll see on the line right below that, which is like line 19, there is a $500,000 one-time appropriation out of the opioid emergency response fund, and we'll come to that item shortly. Going down to starting at line 115, which is where the Department of Human Services starts with the individual items. The first thing is on, I'll mention, is on line 117. That is a governor's recommendation on direct care and treatment. It's blank in the House columns. The items in that are subsumed in the next item in the House, which is on starting on line 124. That is House File 4366. It deals with priority admissions, the governor's recommendation on expanding access to DCT. And I will note at this point, includes keeping the CARES facility in Carlton open. In this, that has a cost of $12,593,000 in net to the general fund in 24-25 and $8,989,000 in the tails. Moving on page two, on line 139 is the governor's acute care transitions item. The House at this point has got a substantially reduced version of that, which costs $843,000 in 24-25 and $4,000 in the tails. Moving to page three, on line 162 is the item on reducing recidivism and preventing overdoses. This is the 1115 reentry waiver. The cost in the House columns, it's close to where the governor is at, but there have been some adjustments as things went forward. This costs $4,882,000 in 24-25 and $8,332,000 in the tails. I'll note we'll come to the very last item on the sheet is also a cost for the same item at the Department of Corrections. We'll be coming to that at the end. Line 179 is a governor's recommendation, which is in the bill, on the opiate response count fee sunset. On line 181 is a governor's item to establish a human services response contingency account. The House bill has a net $2 million for that item as opposed to the governor's $10 million. On line 187 is the governor's recommendation, which is the same in the House language, to sunset the disproportionate share program that creates a savings of $1.451 million in 24-25 and $8.903 million in the tails. On line 192 is the governor's recommendation. This is a no-cost item that has to do with the direct care and treatment separation authority for the new department. Moving on to page 4 at the top, line 194, there are a series of technical items, cleanup items, which you'll note add to zero in zero net cost in 24-25 and zero net cost in 26-27. This is largely putting things in the correct budget activities where they were miscoded prior to this and just moving them from one to another. So it has no actual fiscal effect. Line 201 is House File 3639. This is the Social Determinants of Health 1115 waiver. That's a $709,000 one-time cost at this point. It does not actually start the program. It does the work to lead up to asking for federal approval. On line 207 is the item that continues allowing parents and spouse to act as PCAs in the PCA program. Members will remember that last year we allowed that from the end of the pandemic up to the point at which the new program, CFSS, was assumed to start, that it's a covered service. This is allowed under CFSS. That program has been delayed to this August, I think, is the new date. Anyway, there is a new date for that. This pays for continuing allowing parents and spouse to act in that program from when we assumed it was going to stop in the 23 bill to the new date for CFSS. And that is $4.834 million on, again, a one-time, because once CFSS starts, this is allowable under that program. Line 214 is House File 5228, which is eliminating the remaining TEFRA fees. That's $239,000 in 24-25 and $478,000 in the tails. Line 218 is House File 3445, which is the continuous improvement study. That has a one-time cost of $614,000. On line 224 is House File 4047, which is Representative Bierman's pediatric hospital discharge pilot. That has a net cost of $1.324 million to the general fund in 24-25, and again, nothing in the tails. The last line on that, line 231, is House File 3397, which is Representative Edelson's peer recovery changes bill. It has a cost of $483,000 in 24-25 and $698,000 in the tails. Going to page 5 on line 238 is House File 4940, which is the Dakota County workforce pilot. That has a net cost of $1.206 million in 24-25 and is a one-time item. Line 244 is House File 5200, which includes both the housing support study that was in that bill and also now the establishment of the Office of Homelessness at DHS. That's where it will organize the remaining homelessness programs that stay with DHS and are not going to Children and Families. That has a cost of $854,000 in 24-25 and $822,000 in 26-27. On line 251 is House File 4692. This is the bill to establish the DCT Executive Board and make certain changes to that. That has a one-time cost of $482,000. On line 256 is an item involving community-based entity grants, provider grants, that has a one-time cost of $2,706,000 in no tails. Line 265 is House File 5329, which is the Hennepin County Youth Peer Recovery Project. It's a $500,000 one-time item. I'll note again, this is the spent out of the opioid fund, the settlement account. On line 269 is an item that is seeking to a study to allow navigators to have access to data so that they can help with acute care transitions from hospital. That is $392,000 one time. On page 6, there is on line 275 an item that is seeking to redesign targeted case management. That has a cost of $380,000 in 24-25 and ongoing costs of $152,000 in the tails. Line 281 is part of House File 4705. This is retroactively eliminating the cost, the county cost for DCT for Beltrami County. That is $336,000 one time. On line 285 is House File 3907. This is the Own Home Services Provider Grants item, Representative Vernick's bill. This is $1,468,000 in 24 and 25 only, no tails. On line 291 is an item that seeks to expand the nursing home loan program that was put in Chapter 74 of last year, the nursing home bill that passed at the end of session, which had a home loan, had a nursing home loan item in it, and this is seeking to expand that with some new money, $7,685,000 one time into that loan program. And then on line 295 is a background studies contract review recommendation. This would cost $340,000 net in 24-25 and zero in the tails. And line 300, I will mention, is administrative underspending for FTEs. What this line represents is the department looking at the unfilled FTEs attributable to Chapter 61 from last year. And then there's an assumption of somewhat on how many may yet be hired in 24-25. That leads to an estimate by the department that there is $3,582,000 of spending that isn't going to happen in 24-25. Because our items draw federal funding, when we rescind the money, we have to account for the loss of the federal funds. So we get a net $2,438,000. That represents 68% of the amount that they assume will not be spent. And then there's, as I said, that we lose federal funds on it. And then going to page 7 is the final item, which is the Department of Corrections. This, as I mentioned, is the other part of the reentry waiver. This has a cost of $1,649,000 in 24-25 and $4,288,000 in the tails, and is the same as the governor's recommendation there. And Mr. Chair, that is the whole spreadsheet.
Well, thank you so much, Mr. Berg. So any technical question on the spreadsheet. Lee New Burnley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm looking at line 300, the savings we're booking with unfilled FTEs. Why would that, why would those dollars not be seen in the tails as well?
Mr. Chair, Representative New Brindley, this represents unfilled positions in 2024 only. We don't know going down the road. I mean, there's a presumption that all the FTEs that they plan to hire will ultimately be hired. These are, this is recognizing that some of them that were planned to be hired in fiscal 24 won't be. But it has no impact on the tails because there's an assumption that if they're ongoing FTEs, that they ultimately will be.
Lee New Burnley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We should have serious conversations about that.
We'll do. Any other further question on the spreadsheet? Seeing none, I will now move into the other sections of the bill to go through the language. Ms. Pignan.
Mr. Chair and members, I'll be working off of the bill list that I believe everybody had in their packets. Article 1 is the Disability Services article. There are several sections in this article, sections 1 to 8, 13, 16, 18, 19, and 29 are from Representative Vernig's bill, which eliminates parental fees for certain mental health and disability residential facilities and makes conforming changes throughout the statutes. Sections 9, 12, 15, and 17 are from Representative Knorr's bill, which requires counties to periodically initiate a competitive proposal process for contracted case management services. Sections 10, 11, 22, and 24 are from House File 5280, the governor's bill. It's a governor's proposal providing for MnChoice's flexibility, developing medical assistance, hospital transition benefits, and developing tribal targeted case management. Section 14 is a new proposal. This modifies EIDBI provider qualifications. Sections 20 and 21 are from Representative Pryor's bill, House File 4426, to extend the Direct Care Services Corps pilot project. Section 23 is a modified version of Representative Hicks's House File 3445, which required a Disability Services Continuous Improvement Study. Section 25 is a modified version of Representative Pryor's Bill House File 4203 that provides for assistive technology lead agency partnerships. Section 26 is a new proposal. This reimburses parents and spouses for providing PCA services. Section 27 is from Representative Bierman's House File 4070, which establishes a pediatric hospital-to-home transition pilot program. And finally, in Article 1, Section 28 is from Representative Vernig's bill, House File 3907, to establish own home services provider capacity building grants. The next article, Article 2, is aging services. Sections 1 and 3 are a new proposal. This allows for assisted living facility relocation and provides for a limited exemption from the customized living setting moratorium and age limitations. Section 2 is from Representative Robbins, House File 3654. It modifies requirements for assisted living facility correction orders. Sections 4, 8, and 9 are a new proposal which expands the financially distressed nursing facility loan program to other long-term care services and supports providers, removes the sunset date for the loan program, and makes conforming changes. Finally, in Article 2, Sections 5 to 7 and 10 are from the governor's bill. It's a proposal that provides for elderly waiver disproportionate share off-ramp. Article 3 is the Substance Use Disorder Services article. The first grouping of sections, sections 1, 11, 12, and 19 are a governor's proposal modifying ORAC provisions. Sections 2 to 10 and 16 are from Representative Edelson's House File 3397 modifying peer recovery support services. Sections 8 and 15 are from Representative Frederick's House File 4548, which modifies provisions related to the Ombudsman for Mental Health and Developmental Disabilities. And sections 13, 14, 17, and 18 are from Representative Knorr's House File 3642, which establishes a reentry demonstration waiver. Article 4 is the Priority Admissions and Civil Commitment article. Sections 1, 2, and 5 to 7 are from Representative Edelson's House File 4366, which implements some of the recommendations from the Task Force on Priority Admissions to State-Operated Treatment Programs. Section 3 is from Representative Bliss, reimbursing Beltrami County for certain cost of care payments related to direct care and treatment. And Section 4 is a governor's proposal establishing a task force on mentally ill and dangerous civil commitment reform. Article 5 is the direct care and treatment agency article. Sections 1 to 43 are all from Representative Knorr's House File 4692, which establishes the Executive Board and Chief Executive Officer powers and duties and makes other changes related to establishing a direct care and treatment as an agency. Article 6 is the Human Services Response Contingency Accounts article. There's just one section in this article. It's a governor's proposal establishing the Human Services Response Contingency Account. And then finally, Article 7 is a miscellaneous article. Sections 1, 5, and 6 are from Representative Keeler's House File 5200, establishing an Office of Homelessness and Housing Supports. Section 2 is a new proposal requiring the commissioner to consult with others on targeted case management redesign. Section 3 is from Representative Knorr's House File 3639, requiring the commissioner to develop a social determinants of health waiver. And finally, Section 4 is a new proposal requiring the commissioner to study navigator reimbursement.
Thank you so much, Ms. Pagnotti. Any clarifying question on those articles for the walkthrough? Seeing now, we'll start with the testifiers so we can hear from the public on this proposal. The first person on the list is Commissioner Jody Halstead for DHS. Commissioner, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you very much. Jody Harpstead, Commissioner of the Department of Human Services. Chair Knorr and members of the committee, my name is Jody. I already said that. Thank you for the opportunity to share some brief remarks this afternoon on the House Human Services Supplemental Budget Bill. This year's Supplemental Budget Bill builds on the historic and generational investments in Minnesota's human services system, and even though we're in a non-budget session, makes some important and critical improvements to improve people's lives. We're especially grateful for the inclusion of several of the governor's key supplemental budget priorities, including investments to reduce recidivism and prevent drug overdoses by improving health care for people leaving prisons and jails. This includes a Medicaid demonstration project that would cover physical and behavioral health services in prisons and jails in the 90 days before a person reenters the community, and ongoing funding that will build on the success of bridging benefits to support people to successfully reenter the community following incarceration. These transformative strategies will save lives. They will support Minnesotans to reenter the community successfully after incarceration and help to ensure public safety, racial justice, and equitable behavioral health outcomes. Addressing urgent needs for psychiatric treatment beds within direct care and treatment. Demand for admission to DHS-operated mental health facilities for adults, children, and adolescents has risen dramatically. However, there's not enough capacity to meet the growing needs. Building capacity system-wide will require significant investment over a period of years. In the meantime, these address immediate steps to add treatment capacity where it's needed most and improve admissions at DHS-operated psychiatric hospitals over the next 6 to 12 months. We also greatly appreciate the inclusion of key recommendations from the Priority Admissions Task Force, as well as your many other investments to support people with disabilities, older adults, and people in need of treatment and support for a substance use disorder. As this bill continues to make its way through the legislative process, we hope you'll reconsider a few priorities that either didn't make it into the bill or could use additional attention, including fully funding the Human Services Contingency Account so the department's well-positioned to respond to unexpected and urgent issues that might arise, fully funding investments to improve acute care transitions and address the crisis of people boarding in hospitals and emergency departments. Thank you again, Chair Knorr and members of the committee, for your important work to continue improving the lives of Minnesotans who depend on our state's human service system.
Thank you so much, Commissioner. I appreciate all the work that you do for the department, and we'll keep on having the conversation where we head with this bill. The next person I have on the list is Scott County Commissioner Bob Wickman-Brakey. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Barb Wickman-Brakey, and I'm a Scott County Commissioner. I testify today also on behalf of MAXA, AMC, and MICA. Thank you, Chair Knorr and members, for your work on this bill. These efforts are a foundational role of government, and they are life-changing, life-saving matters. AMC's top priority is to add capacity to our high-acuity mental health system. We truly believe the lack of staff beds for our highest-acuity Minnesotans is at a crisis level. People who have been civilly committed should have access to the court-ordered treatment they require to achieve recovery. And we know jails are not a replacement for mental health hospitals or secure treatment facilities. Mm-hmm. Counties appreciate the recommendations from the Priority Admissions Task Force report that you included in this bill, and we appreciate the hard work of all task force members. This includes expanding DCT's capacity with 16 new psychiatric beds at Forensics. We appreciate the chair maintaining much needed substance abuse capacity and services at CARES Carleton. And we recognize that additional capacity is needed across our mental health continuum of care, and that this is only an initial down payment on capacity in a non-budget year. We recognize that the limitation of budget targets, but next year we need to make permanent the elimination of the DNMC cost of care to counties. We're engaged, counties are engaged and ready to work with you towards these mutual goals. Counties support funding the 1115 reentry waiver. We really hope this pilot can quickly be expanded, as we know there is a desire and a readiness for more than four county jails to participate. Thank you for including funding to improve case management information systems. This is essential to county's transition to a new reporting required to implement the case management redesign. Counties are committed to work with Chair Knorr to address concerns about the contracted case management language and timelines. We also appreciate your increasing the period of time that MN Choices assessments are valid for, from 60 to 365 days. We do ask that other aspects of Chair Fisher's House File 4949 that address timelines for assessments and streamlining reassessments for those whose conditions have not changed still be added to this bill. This is key for workforce capacity and for the experience of those being served. I do sincerely request that the committee consider adding counties as a voting member of the new DCT Executive Board. Counties are uniquely qualified to ensure that DCT meets community needs and coordinates with the broader behavioral health continuum of care, much of which is happening at the local level. Minnesota needs the Department of Direct Care and Treatment, DHS's Behavioral Health Division, and counties to work together seamlessly. We do appreciate the adjustment of the formula for child protection opioid grants to ensure more year-to-year stability in the grant funding. And finally, we really all appreciate your support of specific Hennepin, Beltrami, and Dakota County projects and their needs across the human services spectrum. Thank you, and good luck to you these last weeks.
Thank you so much, Commissioner. The next person on the list is Erin Hubert and also Angela Guerin, if you wanted to tag team on the next. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Angela Guerin with Care Providers of Minnesota, here today on behalf of the Long-Term Care Imperative. First, I want to acknowledge and thank the legislature, this committee in particular, for the $300 million in one-time funding to nursing facilities last session. Those one-time dollars helped keep struggling providers their doors open in a time of crisis. We also recognize the funding that was committed to the Elderly Waiver Program for home and community-based services, including assisted living. However, the funding to nursing homes was one time, and providers are now facing a cliff. In addition, funds dedicated to the Elderly Waiver Program only brought rates to the 2017 levels. Thus, EW is not yet indicative of providers' true costs, and thus not yet fully funded. In fact, EW is the only waiver without an automatic inflationary adjustment. We're disappointed that funding for senior care providers is glaringly absent from the omnibus bill. And the elimination of the disproportionate share program, or DSH, that provides much needed assistance to facilities who predominantly serve low-income residents. In regards to background studies, our providers continuously report significant issues with our current vendor. Delays in processing, ineffective and cumbersome processes that trigger multiple submissions for the same subject, and inadequate access to fingerprinting sites, all of which have a troubling impact on our sector, ultimately losing prospective employees to other professions. In fact, data collected from the Long-Term Care Imperative indicates that 20% of our aging services providers have lost prospective employees due to delays in background study processes. This, paired with the recent cost shift of background studies, has left our providers and their employee candidates frustrated. While we appreciate this committee's willingness to think outside of the box to find a solution on the current vendor, we do not believe that it is feasible to have a study making DHS the sole fingerprinting entity. Instead, we urge this committee to review the current vendor contract and look for opportunities to put more guardrails in place when considering renewing the contract or looking at other vendors. Additionally, we stand ready to provide feedback and work with legislators and the department on solutions and process improvement. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Erin Hubert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Erin Hubert with Leading Age Minnesota, here on behalf of the Long-Term Care Imperative. And to pick up from my colleague, we are very glad to see language reflecting some of the product of the assisted living small provider work group in the omnibus bill. That work group was established last session through this committee. However, some changes impacting food code for small providers, the use of licensed practical nurses within their scope of practice, and some portability for orientation training seem to be absent from the bill. These policy recommendations were also advanced through that small provider work group process and are important to providers of any size. A recently completed fiscal note on those changes would require no state spending to implement, and so we are optimistic that you can include those moving forward. You know, we do have concerns about the language that would repurpose funding established last year specifically to support distressed nursing homes. We know that there are nursing homes right now that are waiting for those grants. I believe the application period actually closes on Friday of this week. In late 2023, when DHS issued an RFI trying to test interest on that loan program, there were over $100 million worth of submitted requests. So diverting promised resources for this loan program before the original recipients can even benefit from it seems premature to us, especially as my colleague indicated, nursing homes face that fiscal cliff at the end of the calendar year. finally, we know that this committee heard Representative Ryer's bill, House File 4839, on implementation of PACE. We recognize that full stand-up may be beyond the committee's capacity and scope for this year, but we hope that there is some opportunity to keep moving forward on some planning steps, some budget-neutral provisions that allow some meaningful progress on that important program. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for your testimony. The next person on the list is Danny Eckert. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Danny Eckert with the Minnesota Hospital Association. In 2023, patients across the state spent roughly 195,000 avoidable days in hospitals, simply waiting for the right level of care to become available. The unprecedented number of avoidable days is due to multiple factors, with some beginning to be addressed in House File 5280 as amended. As such, we support many provisions in this bill, but I want to draw your attention to the following, especially in Article 1. Section 11, which extends the minute choices assessment duration from 60 to 365 days. Section 22, requiring the Commissioner of Human Services to develop a state plan for providing support services during an acute care hospital stay. And Section 27, establishing grants for the Pediatric Hospital to Home Transition Pilot Program. Additionally, given that admissions from county community hospitals to state-operated treatment programs is at an all-time low, we support the multiple provisions included in Article 4, representing the ongoing Priority Admissions Task Force work led by Representative Edelson this session. Specifically, we support the 10-person admission exception for civilly committed patients in community hospital settings awaiting admission to DCT. This will rapidly place 10 patients in the appropriate care setting and will free up community hospital resources to serve more patients. It will also reduce violence and staff harm and begin to address the ever-increasing number of avoidable days across the state. We also support the provisions around medically appropriate priority admissions criteria for civilly committed people or in jail waiting to be admitted to DCT. This will shift the admissions process to DCT towards the patient's needs based on the availability of medically appropriate care. And we support the engagement services pilot grants and their support for delivering prevention services in community settings. We also support the provision in Article 7, Section 3, directing the Commissioner of Human Services to develop a strategy to implement an 1115 waiver addressing social determinants of health, including violence prevention services for medical assistance recipients. In closing, I want to thank Chair Knorr and this committee for working with us on discharge delays and avoidable days this session, both of which remain critical issues for patients across Minnesota. We see this work as only beginning and urge this committee and the legislature to consider funding the acute care transitions work more fully as this session continues. Again, we are grateful for the and support the solid start on this work in House File 5280 as amended, and we'll look forward to continuing our work with this committee, this session, and into the future to provide care for Minnesotans when and where they need it.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Appreciate your testimony. The next person on the list is Tana Fritzinger, and also if Pat Bennett can come to the testify table. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Tanner Fritzinger, and I am the Political Affairs Coordinator for the Minnesota Association of Professional Employees. First, I want to thank Chair Knorr for taking the time to talk with our members on our concerns with the proposed closures of care facilities in Carleton and St. Peter. Additionally, I also want to say thank you to all of you for the support in ensuring that Care Carleton remains open and for providing funding to expand psychiatric beds, bed capacity at AMRTC. However, we still have strong concerns about what the closures of Care St. Peter could entail. Care St. Peter is a residential facility, not one equipped with the proper security to ensure the safety of staff, patients, or the surrounding community. Opening more beds in a non-secure unit could force staff to fast-track the discharge of patients who have not had their risk factors properly addressed. This could pose great safety risks for the community. With the current lack of staff and operational bed capacity, the forensics program often looks not at who is ready for discharge or lower intensity placement, but who is most ready. Further, Care St. Peter is already experiencing staff shortages. Asking care staff who currently work with chemically dependent people to take jobs offered to them in forensics working with clients who have been civilly committed as mentally ill and dangerous is a drastic change in their casework. Two full units at St. Peter Forensics Program are currently offline due to the inability to staff them. Transitioning an additional 16 beds to forensics would only result in more empty beds and worsen the existing staffing shortage. Again, thank you for the progress that has been made to keep CARE Carleton open. We know that this is not a budget year, but we hope that the committee will consider prohibiting any further closures of direct care and treatment facilities until after the new board and the chief executive officer have assumed their management of the new agency and can review our care system more holistically.
Thank you, sir.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Pat Benner. I'm a legislative representative with AFSCME Council 5. I'm here today to express our support for several of the House's positions in the 2024 Human Services Omnibus Finance Bill. So in Article 5, Sections 21, 34, and 39, we appreciate the additions of establishing a Direct Care and Treatment Advisory Council to the Executive Board, expanding the size of the Executive Board to 7 people and 2 non-voting members, and establishing a new requirement that the CEO of Direct Care and Treatment be confirmed by the Senate. We think that all of these changes just add a layer of accountability and give our members an opportunity to express their concerns about program delivery and staffing across the enterprise. And what we are most thankful for, Mr. Chair, is what isn't in this bill. On behalf of the members of AFSCME Local 1092, we all want to thank you for listening to our member, Tara G. Gorehouse, last week in this committee, for listening to our members that have come down, all session to tell their stories, and for deciding to do the right thing by keeping CARE Carleton open. We appreciate the spirit of the debate that we had last week, as well as the consensus that you all found, and appreciate the chair's swift action in finding some resolution. We do hope that over the next couple of weeks, this committee and the department can work to find a suitable and affordable location to expand these psychiatric beds and not cut substance abuse beds in St. Peter. We know that we will be losing the capacity of CARE Wilmer imminently. The likelihood of staff remaining at the St. Peter facility is dubious. Members right now can retire 11 years earlier if they work at the security hospital. They'd likely receive substantial pay raises, and clearly they'd have more job security. But there's a reason that people don't go and take that opportunity. Safety is a much bigger concern inside the fence. The populations are substantially different, and there are also many workers that have true passion for treating substance abuse disorder. Previous closures and mergers also did not have the same jump in acuity and danger that this proposal has. There are 2 empty wings at St. Peter. We've only heard about one that is ramping up staffing. There are alternatives available right now that we could make the same facility conversions at the care facility at St. Peter within the security hospital also in St. Peter, and we won't have to lose staff or beds in order to do so. Thank you all.
Thank you so much. Appreciate your testimony. The next person on the list is Kevin Goodenough. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Kevin Goodenough. I'm with Fredrickson and Byron, a law firm in Minnesota, but I'm here on behalf of my client, Behavioral Health Group, or BHG. BHG is one of the largest providers of OTP, opioid treatment programs in the state. Last year, and I want to thank you all for supporting the change in a new rate system for OTP providers. It was supposed to be implemented January 1st, 2024. What this did was restructure the way that program is funded and also raise the rates. The whole idea behind that was to stabilize the system and also be able to set up the basis for a foundation where we could expand it in the future and expand needed treatments throughout the state of Minnesota. Unfortunately, and I want to draw your attention, and this is why I'm here today, to line 131.30, which moves the effective date for that implementation from January 1st, 2024 to January 1st, 2026. I do think there's a very strong need out there for the opioid treatment programs and the expansion of those programs in the future. I know there are reasons that the department and others in the administration have for this delay, but I would encourage you to work as hard as you can and encourage the others in government to move forward with this implementation far sooner than January 1st, 2026, I would suggest January 1st, 2025 or sooner if possible, because it's very, very much needed within the community. So with that, I'd appreciate your support for moving that date to an earlier date rather than 2026.
Thank you so much for your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, thanks. The next person on the list is Stephanie Rodke. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Nori, members of the committee. My name is Stephanie Radke, and I am president of Portico HealthNet, the largest nonprofit healthcare navigator organization in Minnesota. I'm here on behalf of Portico and a coalition of statewide navigator organizations concerned about the support for critical community-based navigator health access services. I will specifically comment today on the proposed amendment directing the Commissioner of Human Services to study navigator reimbursement and compensation. Most navigator organizations receive two forms of state support: an annual grant, which primarily pays for staffing and outreach, and incentive payments per eligible successful enrollment. Last year, in partnership with the legislature, Minsure, and DHS, we successfully raised the per enrollee incentive payment from $70 to $100 per eligible enrollment. We are grateful to Chair Knorr and for this committee for this much needed financial support. However, our grant payments have remained stagnant since 2016 without any inflationary increase. And while the increased incentive payments have been helpful, they are insufficient. Demand for navigator services have more than doubled since the restart of renewals, and significant barriers persist in communities most in need. Due to demand and lack of funding, it can often take between 21 and 30 days from the time someone is requesting services to being able to receive navigator services. As a result, we do support the proposed amendment calling for a study of navigator compensations. And it would add that navigators need to be the third leg of this study, along with DHS and Minsure. And we request that the language call for collaboration with the Navigator Coalition and not just consultation. We would also like to comment on timing. We have consistently shared that we urgently need additional funding and other technology supports now. Results from this study may not be implemented until fiscal year 26 or 27 at the earliest. This timing does not work for navigators, considering community demand and that the current funding mechanisms remain severely inadequate. There remains a critical need for immediate one-time bridge funding to help navigator organizations meet the continued need of consumers in the midst of the unwinding process, including those whose cases have already been closed due to administrative reasons. We know that the groups with the lowest renewal rates are also the groups with the disproportionately high uninsurance rates. To date, we have been unsuccessful this session with one-time bridge funding request, and we would appreciate reconsideration of that request as the close of this session draws near. Next year, navigators also plan to submit a budget request under the current payment methodology to provide adequate funding pending the results of this study. As a part of that request, we also seek greater access to technology and tools to effectively do our jobs within our communities. And we look forward to sharing more about that in the coming months as we lead into next session. Thank you, Chair Knorr, and to this committee for the past support of navigators. And we also appreciate your consideration of this testimony and the potential additional support this year and going forward.
Thank you so much. The next person I have on the list is Sue Abdeholden. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. Sue Abdeholen, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota National Alliance on Mental Illness. I want to thank Chairman Knorr and the committee members for including several of the recommendations from the Priority Admissions Task Force. As you know, we have a crisis on our hand, and while I know we can't resolve the whole issue, it's good that we're taking some steps forward. We really support the criteria that focuses on acuity and who needs it the most. We think that's important in making sure that people get there who frankly need it the most. We also support allowing 10 people who are committed and have been in community hospitals for long periods of time to be able to get a DCT bed. We also support, of course, increasing the capacity, particularly at St. Peter, so that we can serve more people and fewer people are waiting both in our hospitals and in our jails. I really appreciate keeping some of the money to try to figure out how we can do locked IRFs facilities. We do have some language that we think might help us be able to get Medicaid funding for those in the future, and we really need some locked IRFs facilities in order to address this crisis as well. And then we do support continuing the work of the task force because we need to address the time limitations that are frankly leading to litigations. 48 hours is an arbitrary time limit and can never be met. Also, because this is something I've been working on since 2020, I really, really appreciate you including some money for the voluntary engagement program. I just think this is an opportunity to try it out, see how we can actually intervene early, and so that those families aren't told we have to wait till someone is a danger to themselves or others before we can do anything. We support the 1115 waiver so we can try to connect people leaving the prisons or jails to the treatment and supports they need in the community when they are discharged. We also want to thank you for ending parental fees and for the federal waiver to really look at the social determinants of health. We had sent a letter suggesting a few amendments to the bill, which we still hope you'll take under consideration. One is including a family member on the MIND commitment task force. It's actually, that's a task force I served on many years ago, and it was helpful to have a family member on it. And then also including a tribal government representative on the DCT executive committee, since there are direct contracts with some of the tribes. Again, I thank you for including these items in the omnibus bill. You know, I know that you can't address the entire mental health crisis that we're experiencing, but these are some good steps forward. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony. The next person on the list is Megan Peterlins. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Noor and committee members. My name is Megan Peterlins, and I'm the Community Affairs Manager at Children's Minnesota. I appreciate you having me here today to express our support for Article 7, Section 3 in the Human Services Omnibus Bill. Specifically, we support the development of a strategy to invest in health-related social needs, including nutrition and housing support, case management, and violence prevention. Children's Minnesota is the state's largest pediatric healthcare system. We serve a diverse patient population, and nearly 50% of our patients are enrolled in Medicaid. Our vision is to be every family's essential partner in raising healthier children, and that starts with recognizing that 80% of what impacts the health of a child happens outside of our hospital and clinic walls. Equitable access to social supports, including food, housing, and safe communities, is essential to ensuring the health and wellness of children and their families. In my role at Children's Minnesota, I have the privilege of leading our community health needs assessment process. These assessments are one of the ways we engage the communities we serve and respond to what they want us, as a healthcare provider, to prioritize when it comes to their health and wellness. I am here testifying before you today because access to basic resources like food, housing, and a safe place to live, work, and go to school have been elevated through this process. Another way we learn about families' health-related social needs are when they participate in a social needs screening in one of our clinics. Food insecurity and housing issues are regularly identified as top concerns. Families can meet with a community resource navigator through our Community Connect program to help address those concerns. In addition to that work, when a child comes into our emergency room as a victim of violent injury, we are able to connect them to the Next Step Hospital Violence Intervention and Prevention Program, which connects survivors to resources and support to interrupt the cycle of violence and help avoid future injury. If these services were paid for by medical assistance, our capacity and the capacity of our community partners to support these families would increase in an incredibly impactful way. Our communities are telling us what they need to be healthy, and Children's Minnesota, along with hospitals and health systems across the state, are working to be responsive to those needs. This bill gives us the opportunity to explore how we can use current systems to invest in what we know supports families' health and overall well-being. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you so much. The next person is Zania Harut. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
All right. Good afternoon, Chair Noor, members of the committee. My name is Zania Harut, and I am the board chair of the Residential Providers Association, also known as RPAM. RPAM's members are primarily black and brown providers who serve Minnesotans with disabilities under the assisted living and newly community residential services license. We are grateful for the language in House File 5280 that would allow assisted living facilities to relocate. The language in Article 2, Sections 1 and 3 are the result of nearly 2 years of work with the stakeholders, MDH, and DHS, and other stakeholders. While there are still some details to iron out in the final weeks of the session, I cannot overstate how significant this language is to the hundreds of small, predominantly black and brown providers that RPMN represents. You have heard the RPMN leaders testify for 2 years about the unintended consequences of the new assisted living license. On the new assisted living license law on small providers serving individuals on medical assistance and single family homes. One of those unintended consequences was the impact of the statutory moratoriums on new small assisted living and customized living settings, many of whom have historically been renting their homes where the clients reside. The current statutory requirement in place means that providers who rent their licensed setting are they're completely vulnerable to landlords. Frequently, providers find themselves in difficult situations with landlords who tend to take advantage of the fact that the providers cannot relocate. Some of the issues that our providers have faced include steep rent increases, deferred maintenance, physical plant non-compliance, and other issues that are not conducive to keeping our homes safe and comfortable for the residents we serve. The current moratorium prevents providers from leaving hostile situations and also prevents providers, many of our BIPOC providers who would like to actually buy the home that they provide services in. The language in this bill would allow for small assisted living providers to move to a new location while not losing their 144G license due to the moratorium on their grandfather's status to provide customized living to people under the age of 55, which has been a serious issue in the last few years. That's vital to providing stability to our culturally specific provider community as well as the residents we serve. And Chair Noor, I really want to thank you for your inclusion of this proposal, and we look forward to continued collaboration.
Thank you. The last person on the list is Marcus Schmidt. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Good afternoon, Chair Noor and committee members. Thank you for the opportunity to share testimony on the legislation before you today. My name is Marcus Schmidt, and I'm fortunate to lead Hearth Connection, an organization uniquely positioned between government, service providers, and community stakeholders across the state. Our focus at Hearth Connection is supportive housing, where we connect service provider partners with resources to serve people with long histories of homelessness. For us and our housing provider partners across the state, housing, that is supportive housing, is both a noun and a verb. You need the affordable, safe place for people to live, and you also need the support to help people find it and keep it, with services that help improve people's well-being and their stability. We know there's urgency in our communities, rural, suburban, and metro, to provide long-term solutions for people with long histories of homelessness. Supportive housing is a proven long-term solution for breaking the cycle of homelessness. It's been tested in Minnesota and across the country. Simply put, supportive housing works. Over the past 15 months, we organized 75 community conversations across Minnesota focused on identifying actionable solutions to long-term homelessness. These conversations engaged 72 of our 87 counties, the Northern Minnesota Tribal Nations, and more than 520 of our fellow Minnesotans. 11 of these community conversations were exclusively focused on convening people with lived expertise of homelessness. The purpose of these conversations was really to get to actionable solutions, and we did. One of the most substantial takeaways is the need to simplify a complicated web of housing systems and resources that are confusing and overly complex. We heard from service providers, people with lived experience, and other key stakeholders that simplifying supportive housing resources will improve housing access, stabilize a struggling direct service workforce, and enhance our investment in homelessness response and prevention. This bill empowers a statewide simplification supportive housing work group with deep knowledge of and experience with existing resources to act with the intentionality and urgency we need to advance long-term solutions to homelessness. Furthermore, directing energy toward the establishment of an Office of Homelessness elevates supportive housing as a long-term solution within the full housing continuum. I'm inspired by the bipartisan enthusiasm we've experienced for this effort. Thank you to members of this committee on both sides of the aisle for your support. We're grateful to you, Mr. Chair, Representative Fisher, and especially Representative Keeler, for her leadership on our homelessness challenges in Minnesota. We look forward to ongoing collaboration with you, agency partners, community members in the coming weeks to ensure that the Supportive Housing Simplification Work Group is established, moves with urgency, and equips this legislature with actionable solutions to long-term homelessness. Thank you for the opportunity to share this testimony, and thanks so much for your public service.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Just wanted to ask if there's anyone in the public who really wants to testify on this bill. Going once, going twice. All right, back to the member discussion for a few minutes, and we'll have more discussion on Thursday. Representative Baker.
Thank you. Thank you, member, Mr. Chair and members. This is our work this year. If I could, Mr. Chair, ask for Commissioner Harpstead to come back forward, if that's possible.
If the commissioner is here.
Is that okay? Yeah, thanks. As she walks up here, I have a unique perspective of working with Commissioner Harpstead. Like I do in workforce, I fight hard to try and do what I think is reasonable in today's world of not having enough people to do our work. And being able to travel around the state with Commissioner last fall, which I really enjoyed and got to know her and her team better, she has a really good team. And I know a lot of times it gets kind of political and a little mudslinging, but they really do have people that care. And when I see this year's work and what we have to do, not only do I want to thank you for all you do, it's a enormous job and I can't imagine. And when you and I were visiting, I remember after last session, you had the daunting task of hiring 1,000 people. That was what our ask was of her, of the department, of the committee, just the whole thing. 1,000 people. And we're seeing today some clawbacks because they're not spending money in certain areas for unfilled staff. There's money coming back from withdrawal management in other areas. There's things that they're not able to get to. And it's not because they're not trying. My concern this year is, and I'm asking this in an honest, genuine way, is my work with ORAC has been a very small, tiny piece of what DHS is and what they do and the impact they have on lives. And what we do at ORAC is we are taking a lot of money in. We're standing up things as fast as we possibly can, sometimes I think faster than what we can do and do it well. My direction to this is because last year was such a transformative year, I feel like we need to say, wait a minute, we should pause for a minute and give you more time, and we should find more money in areas that we want to spend in, that we do have a small target here, but I'm concerned about pushing you further down a way in a period of time that you don't know, and I want to ask this question is, would you think that us even holding back on some good programs like the reentry program that I really support for the 1115 waiver, and I think that's a great bill. It also has money in the tails, but it's standing up a new program. It's standing up a lot of work, something that I believe in. But I also know timing is everything. But we didn't do a lot of good things last year. We didn't finish it right, like you heard Mr. Goodnow say that the opioid treatment program rate study could do a lot more, but it was passed here last year in 2024. But because of DHS changes or the MNIT couldn't get it out in time, now it's being delayed to 2026 because they just can't get it out the door. That's literally what they're telling us. It's like $1 million that we're looking for. I'm sorry, I'm going to get to your question. How much would you appreciate or not appreciate the ability for the legislature, all of us here, to just allow you to kind of take a breath and catch up with some of these major things that happened and us to be honest about the ability for you to keep churning out new programs and new things and new ideas that are actually pretty effective, but we still have to do it in a way that takes people. So, Commissioner, I'm not saying that we don't want to do some things here, and we are going to do some things. Are you feeling, would it be something reasonable in your mind to let us to try to tap the brakes a little bit, to give you the time, maybe some other resources that didn't quite get done last year properly, to do it in a way that gives you a chance to catch up a little bit? Are we coming at you sometimes too fast?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Rep. Baker, there's a question I wasn't expecting. Thank you for asking.
But I want you to be honest, too. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, a few things. I would share that we have recently taken a look back and found that over the last decade, for example, we've increased our staffing in the Behavioral Health Division by 74% and increased our grants by 740%. And so I do appreciate your asking about, we're all excited about the abundance we've been able to talk about here in Minnesota, and it has been a daunting level of work. A lot of it has been about simply going through the HR steps properly of creating the position descriptions and classifying positions and then doing the interviews. And it, after last year's session, it has been a lot. We've done all we could to catch up. My behavioral health staff, for example, was also off at a recent national SAMHSA meeting listening to the secretary of SAMHSA apologizing for the pile of grants they sent our way this last year and expecting millions of dollars in federal funding not to be spent this fiscal year because of the inability of state staff to get all the grants out. So we appreciated his acknowledgement of that. As a result, SAMHSA is extending the current level of grants that they gave us last year because they know that there's trouble in states across the country trying to get everything done. So we're doing some things like that. The reentry grant, interesting that you would ask, I just took a couple of my senior people over to CMS in Washington for a day. They gave us 4 hours to ask their senior teams any questions we wanted to ask. And we asked about the reentry waiver and the 10, we have a total of 10 waivers that different people would like to see us introduce in Minnesota. And I think we have a good handle on the reentry waiver, and I think the bill that's running is a good bill, and I think it describes the kind of work we would all like to do together. They also mentioned that they have a backlog, and so in that particular instance, I think we had better get ourselves in that queue if we're going to see the reentry waiver happen in Minnesota. So I wouldn't want to withdraw that one, for example. And so I really don't have a list of things that I would have you not do. I think we should spend the dollars that we have available and that are suggested in this bill. But I very much appreciate the question, and we will be asking for some patience as we try to get through all of the things that we've been able to do together over the last couple of years. I hope that answers your question.
Representative Baker.
Mr. Chair, and it does. I know that, it's the reality of today because everybody is backed up, and we can easily say, why didn't you get this done? Because it was given to you last year. And it's easy for us to sit here, members, to point fingers and point blame and say, what is going on at DHS? Mm-hmm. They're overwhelmed. And let's just admit it. We're part of the problem here, folks. And I go back to things that we're searching for dollars. I wish we had, on the second year of this biennium, I wish we had spent less in other areas last year and focused more on health and human services, because then we don't have to feel like we have this crisis ahead of us. And it gives them 2 years to really work through this stuff instead of coming with every year with new programs and new ideas and new shiny objects. And we have to be careful with that. Because of a lack of time here, I want to ask at some point about, the dollars. And we'll go through this sometime, Chair Noor, about the $500,000 request of the ORAC fund. Hennepin County has already received over $3.3 million. We have a very good program. I would not want to support that funding through that fund, but it's a great program you're trying to support. I want to find other ways to do that, because once legislators start dipping into the ORAC fund in a way that we've got a very good granting process already set up, Hennepin County has done a very good job getting a lot of the dollars so far. They're already receiving $71 million from the settlement funds in Hennepin County alone. There's a lot of money there that's coming to Hennepin County. It's coming over 15 years, so that's good for them. But this project, the pilot project, should not come from the legislature through ORAC. again, we missed the 3%. My last thing is we missed the 3% reimbursement last year, members. In the final hours of our conference committee, that would have given substance use disorder folks in the workforce a very small increase in their rates. We didn't do that. We didn't do it last year. And I'm fighting for everything I can this year, because if we don't maintain and stop the closing of SUD facilities around the state of Minnesota, last couple years it's been 45 have closed, the net opening and closing net loss is 45 places. If we don't get that figured out first, if we don't get our foundation right, the folks we want to help that are getting released in the reentry aren't going to have a place to go to. We aren't going to get it right if we don't do our dollars first here. Take a breath. Let's get it figured out here. We've got, I think, some rooms open in St. Peter that we can talk about. We can talk about the Juniper unit, the Elm unit, the Ironwood unit that they want to utilize. I want to know how many beds are open. I want to ask those questions, but I know we're running out of time. But I just want to be honest about our work here needs to slow down sometimes so that the people that actually have to execute our plan have time to do it right, and we get the funding in the right places so that we don't just dibble and drabble and throw it around everywhere and say we did something, yet we're making it harder for Commissioner Harpstead and her team to do the work that they need to do. So I want to start thinking smart about that. So I appreciate this rambling a bit, and I look forward to our next meetings to get this bill better. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Any closing remarks, Commissioner?
Just one, Chair Noor and Rep Baker. We've had conversations with both of you about the possibility of redesigning the way we do some of our funding, especially for behavioral health, because all those grants are no way to build a behavioral health system. So we'll be back next session with some ideas on how to redesign perhaps direct funding to some of our tribal and county partners instead of all the RFPs that even they have to fill out to get our dollars.
Thank you so much, Commissioner. Lee New Binley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Commissioner. My questions for now, I'm just pulling up the language. My questions for now are regarding the Human Services Response Contingency Account. And I'm wondering, obviously, this language is very, very broad. It can be used for health, welfare, safety of people, which is virtually anything. The things that are allowed to be spent on services, supplies, equipment, training, coordination, communication, outreach, IT, staffing, money can be transferred between departments. So basically, it can be for any purpose and be used on anything within those areas. My question is, can you give us some examples of things you have not been able to do without this account?
Mm-hmm. Commissioner.
Chair Noor and Rep. New Brindley. Just a couple of examples of things we've come to close to that we didn't have dollars. A couple times looking at encampment responses in Minnesota, sometimes needing urgent funds and not sure how we were going to deal with that, and finding ways through the county and others to deal with the situation. We've had a couple of situations with our Office of the Inspector General looking at either revoking a license or at a temporary immediate suspension based on licensing requirement concerns, where we thought, what are we going to do if we need to close this provider, and have found other providers to step in and actually acquire the provider in question. And sometimes I feel like that was clever, and sometimes I think that was just lucky. And so if we ever needed dollars for some of those kinds of things, we have almost no just discretionary funding between sessions to do those kinds of things. So those are a couple of examples of the things we've had in mind with that.
In your bin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We've just in this bill, we've booked over $2 million. And clearly that, you know, I mean, that those FTEs particularly are appropriated every budget. And it's really the same story every budget cycle. And as Representative Baker said, frankly, I certainly believe that you try to fill positions that there are just no bodies to fill them. And yet that funding still exists. That funding is always there. And I don't believe that funding goes unspent. And so it seems like there is
clearly money sort of baked in that, you know, frankly, it's something we probably need to consider as legislators, a better way of dealing with that. I mean, you know, frankly, it's not just DHS, right? I mean, we just got numbers from MDH that, you know, only half of their FTEs have been filled. I mean, it's a problem across the board, but it creates a pretty significant pot that this is unusual. This budget is unusual in that we've chosen to actually capture those savings and use them elsewhere. Usually those savings go uncaptured and just remain with the department. So there are additional funds out there, and I continue to have concerns with, you know, I mean, this is our most fundamental responsibility as a legislature is to appropriate funds. And we should absolutely have a say in how that is being done. So I appreciate that. My other questions are not necessarily for Commissioner Harpstead, but perhaps Chair Knorr for you, if you want to get into those other questions or if you wanted to allow other questions for the commissioner while she's here. I don't know how you want to handle that.
I just wanted to respond to the question about the unspent FTE funding. Mm-hmm. As we all know, any unspent funding, I think Mr. Budd can actually correct me if I'm wrong, it cancels back to the general fund. It does not stay with the department. So it's either you use it or you lose it, knowing that the process for a long time. So I just wanted to make sure that that is the correct process. So even if the department didn't use it, this money will have just gone to the general fund. Lee Newbin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess I would ask Mr. Berg for clarification on that, because certainly I understand that that's the policy. that's what's supposed to happen, and yet rarely do we get accurate counts of this kind of information. So I'm wondering if we know that we do have an accurate accounting of that and how that actually cancels back in real life, how that actually functions.
And as Mr. Berg is speaking, I think we just passed the corrections, the bill that we just passed, was it last week?
Yep.
That included all those things that were not spent, which we had to make those corrections.
Mr. Chair, two things are getting mixed here. That one is related. Yes, the forecast article updates forecasted programs for the now, at this point, two forecasts that have occurred since 2023 session ended. That's one thing, which in some cases saved money from programs, and we enact that, and it drops to the bottom line. And in a couple cases, it increased funding, again, based on forecasts. The other thing on this that I would point out is that there is a thing called the cancellation report, which I don't know if any members here have ever looked at. It's a pretty technical thing that happens at the end of each biennium. I could get you a copy of it. But it shows at the end of a fiscal year, the close of a biennium, the cancellations that occurred from the entire state budget, which are significant and are identified by budget activity. Now, it doesn't say in that report when it says DHS has canceled, you know, some number, pick it from some budget activity. It doesn't say because it's, you know, 10 FTEs and, you know, something else, but we do have that report, and it's a standard thing that shows how much money that was appropriated and expected to be spent wasn't. And I do not have it off the top of my head. If you think at the end of 23, it was a pretty significant number, and I hesitate to, I don't remember exactly, but it was in the tens of millions of dollars that canceled back, and I actually think it, relatively high tens of millions, but I would, without going back to look at the report, I don't want to say a number. So we do actually, and people like me look at that, and the budget people at the department and at MMB look at that. So, I mean, there is a process where we verify that money did not get spent, and at this point is canceling to the bottom line of whichever fund it came on. This happens in all funds of state government. So, yes, there is that accountability. There isn't a specific one on FTEs, I don't believe. We get into a lot of technical stuff there. There's the departmental earnings report that looks at that from the issue of revenue coming in. We also get to see what happens there. So there are a variety of ways that we can see what really happens in the budget.
Thank you so much, Mr. Buck. I think the cancellation that is correct, Mr. Buck, is the forecasted program that we did. And then the other pieces is the cancellation. And thanks for sharing with me that big file last year at the beginning as I wanted to go through most of that process. It's a lengthy spreadsheet. So if you wanted to add anything, Lee Newbrun.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I appreciate the clarification on that cancel back and that it does not have a line item. It does not delineate where that money goes for FTEs. Thank you.
Representative Zalesnica.
Thank you, Chair. And thank you, Commissioner, for the presentation. Back in 2020, NPR News highlighted inpatient psychiatric care needs across the state of Minnesota, saying that there were 10 to 15 patients that they saw on a monthly basis in ERs. So when I look at this, knowing that we're transporting kids to North Dakota because we don't have inpatient beds, and I know that from being on the EMS task force because ambulance drivers are calling me to say, we're leaving greater Minnesota to transport a child that's 10 to North Dakota. We have 40% increase in mental health. It's just in everything we read. So as I understand it, we're adding 8 beds for children. We're adding 16 beds for adults. And we're going to allow 10 priority admissions to be determined from the hospitals to go to DCT. So my question is, when I look at the state map of where we have beds, we have 690 beds. Looks kind of like this. That's on the state website. And it's color-coded. And in that color code, there's really nothing in northeastern Minnesota. There's nothing in really northwestern Minnesota. We have a few things. The one thing that we would have lost, which looks like we're going to keep, which I'm happy, I went to tour it on Friday, is Care Carlton, the only all-women substance center for women that are pregnant. Spent 2 hours there with Rep. Dodseth, and appreciate that DHS was there with us too. And it was highlighting the importance of what we're going to lose. And it was obvious to me, in spending a few hours there, how significant this is going to be for northern Minnesota, greater Minnesota. And we basically have, you know, levels of care. We have community, the places that are like Care Carlton. We have the behavioral health hospital, six of them with 16 beds. We have Anoka Metro with 96 beds for psychiatric. We have Forensic that says 370 beds. And we have 46 beds for Minnesota Specialty Health System, 316 bed facilities. That's what we have in the state of Minnesota for 5.6 million people. So my question is, with 690 beds right now in service, will your proposal for the 8 beds for children, 16 beds for adults, meet the current needs after highlighting? We've heard that we have 50% higher civil commitments and 40% higher mental health. Are we going to safely and adequately be able to meet the needs of some of the most vulnerable people? My concern is if we don't, they're going to end up homeless. We've already spent a lot of time talking about homeless issues. And so I would like to hear from the department if this plan is going to strategically do it, because the numbers seem extremely low to me for the high demand. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Commissioner, any response?
Chair Noor and Rep, not at all. I mean, it's just scratching the surface. After the Priority Admissions Task Force, when we talked about how much capacity might be needed, and you can see the numbers in that task force report of what the group thought were needed to get us somewhere in this overall national, if not global, behavioral health crisis that we're in, this is all we could do with the slim forecast this year. And so we're looking forward to coming back with more proposals going forward. We were also concerned about any proposals to build new buildings, which might have taken 2 to 3 years before we opened the first beds. And so we focused on converting the services that we had to open up as many beds as we could for psychiatric use. And so we've done the best we could with what we had to work with this year, and we've got much more to do in the state of Minnesota to attempt to meet the need.
Representative Snicker, any follow-up?
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Commissioner. I mean, you said it. I can't say it any better. We are in a crisis, and we've been in a crisis for years, and it's disappointing to me that when we had $17.5 billion, we didn't do something that this entire state needs, which is behavioral health and mental health. We have 40% increased mental health, and we do not have inpatient beds. It is disappointing at every level, and it's going to affect the ambulance system. It's going to affect treatment. It's going to affect homelessness. It's going to affect everything. So when we look at going downstream, I hear that term a lot. We are not set up to care for the people, fully knowing we have 40% increase in mental health. And I'm very concerned that we don't have a master plan ready to go for 2-3 years. Because the need is there. The hospitals have been telling us for the entire year, 2 years I've been here, and it's been a fact before I ever got here for the committee here to hear, to listen to. So it isn't an issue that DHS or MDH or anyone else can address until this body addresses the fact that we need bonding for mental health in a hospital for this state. We have land in Anoka. I grew up an hour from there. We own the land there, as I understand it. So why we're not taking initiatives to have safe, secured settings that would be appropriate for people to have a dignified setting is incomprehensible to me. So we must do better because the issue is not going away. It's going to go to the ER is where it's going to go. And they already told us they can't handle it. So I don't have any further comments. Thank you for what you're doing. I'm glad we have 8 beds and 16 beds. It's just not enough.
We have 1 minute left, and we'll go to Representative Quam and then followed by Gilman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this will be an offline. You'll have to get back with information. I'd like to understand the granularity of the spending so that you have multiple, you have a group within DHS or other departments of where they have 4 or 5 different variations of programs and services for, say, mental health or drug addiction, et cetera. What's the granularity to see exactly that they have spent so much on each of these different programs compared to in general? Because there are well-documented cases of where a entity that was funded didn't fill positions and utilize that money for something not specifically outlined by the legislature on a pet project. And so, you know, offline, hopefully before the next meeting of this committee, I'd like to understand the granularity and detail of how far this, the budget, the actual spending feedback we get is.
Representative Gilmer.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Commissioner, for being here. Just a quick question in regards to space that's available currently right now. In 2020, 2021, lots of folks, even this body here, went home and did a lot of at-home work and worked remotely. Curious about your building, and has your task force looked at the opportunity of space that's not being utilized, even at your current space at the DHS building? Have we thought about just entities coming together from different, you know, MnDOT, DHS, consolidating in one space because people are still working remotely, or some are, probably a lot of folks are working remotely. So these buildings that are there, you know, could be utilized like right now and could be turnkey ready to go with some, you know, modifications. But have you thought about coming together and just economically the impact on that versus having three quarters of a building that's empty, or even looking at spaces in downtown Minneapolis where people can pick things up pennies on the dollar for space that's beautiful, amazing, and then working on looking at that. Has the task force looked about just kind of combining different government agencies into one space and looking at that because we already own it?
Commissioner.
Yes, Chair Noor, and Rep. Gilman, we have a constant conversation going on across the entire state enterprise about how we would consolidate the footprint of our buildings because of remote work, absolutely. So we're looking at the best ways to do that, especially as different leases expire. We've already consolidated a little bit of the different, we had a couple of other departments of DHS and other buildings that have moved now into our main Anderson building. And we continue to look at that as we look toward the future and we look at when various leases expire. So we are looking to consolidate the footprint of our office buildings. And, of course, our office building is very different from our DCT service facilities. So I don't think that's what you were talking about. But we are looking at ways to consolidate the footprint of office buildings when people are long-term working remotely.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Commissioner and members. The deadline for the amendments to the DE are due at 5 p.m. tomorrow. So that's the deadline we have for the amendments. So if you have any amendments coming through, please make sure you send through. With that, we don't have any other agenda items. We are now adjourned.